Mr. Rick.
Mr. Elliot, how are we?
Very well, very well. Excited for today's show.
Yes, new show for everybody out there.
New show. If you haven't caught our little trailer, which will above you if you listen to our show on Apple or Spotify or other apps, we have a new show with the guys, just for history, from the RE of Marketing, the RE of Marketing podcast, which still exists and is still published. Yeah. But we've changed. We've dropped the marketing because we weren't very good at that part of the conversation. Yeah. But we were really good at the remarkable, the rethinking, the reframing, the redefining stuff. So we've started a whole new show, slightly adjacent to the old one, to do just that.
Yeah, we're basically doing exactly the same as what we did before, but not trying to get marketing speak into it. So it should be a bit better.
It should be a bit better. And it opens us up to a world of non-marketing guests, including today's special guest, which is Mr. Adam Buss, who is somebody you may not have heard of unless you reside in Derby or Derbyshire. He is the hub, right? The man leading the charge at the centre of everything good in Derby. He's the CEO of Quad. He's on the Creative Industries Council. He's heavily involved in Derby's City of Culture bid and Creative Enterprise Zone. And he's just a champion for everything creative and culture and community within the city. And it's going to be an epic conversation, I think.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Really looking forward to it.
But and that's not the only news, right?
No, I was about to say, there is a second piece of news, isn't there, Tim?
There is a second piece of news. Now we've been podcasting for a while. We've progressed to professional podcasters, and we have... Don't laugh so hard. It's true.
No. It was a jovial laugh.
Oh, like an encouragement laugh.
Yes, that one.
Excellent. But the reason for Steve's encouragement, vocal encouragement, is that we have a new sponsor, and it's Bant.io, right? An amazing, remarkable bit of software that helps us entrepreneurial types with lead generation, which will free up a bunch of time for us to do more remarkable, more creative, more human things. But I'm not going to try and butcher the introduction into what they do. They've recorded their own message. So here it comes.
Hi, I'm Steve Rick.
And I'm Tim Elliott.
Welcome to The Remarkable Show.
This is a podcast based on the philosophy of RE.
Rethinking, reframing and remarking on good people doing remarkable things.
Just before we get cracking with this episode's guest, I want to shout out our very first sponsor, the amazing Bant.io, the all-in-one B2B lead generation toolkit designed to automate your customer acquisition. Now, we're all busy doing remarkable stuff. That's why software like Bant.io is super important to us, to help us manage our businesses and streamline our activities. So check them out in the show notes. All the links, all the info you'll need is in there. But now let's get on with this show. Our guest has arrived, Mr. Adam Buss. Do you want to introduce yourself, sir, to our audience?
Yeah, happy to. So I'm Adam. I'm currently, and I say currently for a reason that will become clear, currently the chief executive of Quad, which is Derby Centre for Contemporary Art, Digital Media and Independent Film. But today it was announced that also I'm going to be taking on the role of bid director for Derby's City of Culture bid for 2025. So exciting times are happening.
That is exciting. That is exciting. We will come on to that because what we've alluded to into the introduction is a bit of everything around creativity, around kind of the purpose of cities and creative skills, especially because our friend Mr. Rick over there on the screen is education background. But I thought we'd kick off today's conversation because this week, as if by magic, right? There's been a lot of talk around creative skills on the internet world. So two of the guru type fellas that I follow on the internet world is Simon Sinek and Adam Grant, right? And both this week have been talking about creative skills. So I'm going to read those two short Instagram posts, and then we'll start our free-flowing, intelligent, amazing conversation as we planned before, right?
We do use the word intelligence, really. You know, we hold it in high regard, and we shouldn't.
We shouldn't. We shouldn't. Right.
Adam, I hope you're intelligent, Adam, because... You
know. Well, we're about to find out, aren't we? So, let's see what happens.
We're about to find out. We have a discerning audience. They're very forgiving, aren't they?
Yeah, very, that's good. Very forgiving.
Right, here we go. Right. So this is from Simon Sinek on the Instagram. So there's no such thing as soft skills. Let's stop using the term soft skills. There's nothing soft about them. Let's call them what they really are, human skills. Plus hard and soft are opposites. In reality, our hard skills, the skills we need to do our jobs, and our human skills, the interpersonal skills we need to be able to work well with others and work together, make us great team members and great leaders. So that was Simon Sinek, that's number one. They're both of similar vein, so I'll read Adam Grant's now. The irony of soft skills is they're often the hardest to master. Leadership, communication, collaboration, creativity, and adaptability may not be technical, but they are increasingly vital. Behavioral, social, and emotional skills are what make humans indispensable in the workplace.
Bang on. Yeah, agree.
Agree. Shortest podcast ever. Amazing. but I thought that was quite relevant for the three of us, because I mean, we know from previous conversations in each other in the real world that I have a lot to do with creative skills and kind of just ranting a little bit and championing and putting forward, being like an evangelist for the creative skills in the workplace and working more creatively, especially in the sectors and in parts, little pocket cultures of our community that don't consider themselves creative, right? About championing that. And you, Adam, are obviously, as we alluded to in the introduction, really the fulcrum of everything good and creative in the city of Derby, which makes I'm putting it out there, right?
Well,
it's good for the new job role credibility.
Yeah, it's useful.
Sorry, carry on.
I was just going to say, so going back to the kind of two Instagram pages, two things that kind of strike me straight away that have sort of informed every part of my life. One is kind of where I came from and the fact that there are, you know, it's the sliding doors thing, isn't it? But it's like, for me, sliding doors is not like a moment. It's kind of like a year or, you know, a period of your life where things could have gone a completely different tangential direction. And for me, early years, sort of growing up on a council estate in the southeast of England, going to school and kind of feeling a little bit sort of peripheral, I guess, to a certain extent, not really understanding what the future might hold. And this is said not with any sense of criticism, particularly of my parents, because it just... My dad was a postman, my mum cleaned hospitals and was a home help and various other things. It just wasn't, you know, the kind of career aspirations they had for us as kids, me, my brother and my sister, were that we would effectively do more than them. That was it. That was the simple yet, you know, really powerful message that they gave us. We want you to have more opportunities than us. But in terms of what those opportunities were, where they came from, how we would get into them, all that kind of stuff, they didn't have that knowledge and experience. So they weren't able to kind of say, you know, if you want to do X, you should do this, this and this. So I was incredibly lucky that at school I met a teacher, and this is probably something Stephen knows more than anyone else, you know, and has got countless stories like this, but I met a teacher who was my drama teacher that not only said, you know, I think you've got some talent and you can do things, but that actually a career in the creative industries, not that it was called that at the time, is a feasible thing for you, and you can do this, and it doesn't, you don't have to be living and working in London. You don't have to, you know, have all those contacts. There are ways to kind of make this happen. And that always, I always think about that, because there is a point there, you know, there's another reality where that person doesn't take that much interest in me, that doesn't support me, that doesn't give me that insight, where I'm, you know, no offense to them, but I'm probably something like an estate agent or something in that realm, because, you know, I would imagine I'd always be kind of quite confident, you know, able to talk, all that kind of stuff. And I probably would have gone into some kind of sales-based environment, I think, just pure out-and-out sales, and that would have been it. But actually what I'm doing now is a lot more relevant, I think, to what I am as a person. So there's that element. And then just the other element that, you know, I learnt this fact about, I don't know, it was 15 years ago, something like that, which is the, and it's a really, it feels obvious now, but when I heard it, I was like, wow, that makes a massive amount of sense. You know, in the fact that our IQ, our intelligence quota, as defined, effectively is kind of capped at around 18, 19, 20, 21, that kind of time period, where your IQ is no longer going to increase past that point. You're not going to get any more clever. You might learn new things, but in terms of your level of IQ, it's not going to get more than that. But your EQ, your intelligence quota, your ability to empathize and understand the world, that can carry on growing until the day you die. And again, it goes back to what you were saying, Tim, is that actually surely that ability for us as humans to continue to develop that skill is something we should embrace and embrace more. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about lifelong learning, and quite often it means someone trying to retrain or do something else. But actually lifelong learning can be that ethereal, you know, university of life stuff, where actually, you know, through good and bad experiences, you're gaining empathy and you're gaining more emotional intelligence to be able to work in the world in a better way and work with people in a better way and, you know, gradually become better. But we don't, for some reason as a society, sort of push that message or get people to kind of think about it. And then just one quick final thing that kind of followed on from that. There's a book called Staring at the Sun, which is a really interesting take on our relationship with death. taking us off into a different tangent now. But the point being that, you know, it's an inevitability for all of us. And the time it hits hardest, obviously, is when it's someone close to us. And, you know, we as a species are sort of, certainly in the Western world, we've kind of conditioned ourselves to sort of ignore it until it happens and then deal with it afterwards. Whereas the book kind of proffers the idea that you should be talking about and thinking about what that experience of loss and death and all of those things is like, so that at the point when you do lose someone that's really close to you, it isn't as significant an impact on you as a human being. But that's a difficult thing to kind of have the conversation about, because, you know, none of us want to think that people close to us are going to die, but sadly they are at some point. And, you know, how do we approach that? So all of that and all of those things and all of that stuff, I think, goes back to exactly what your Instagram post was saying, Tim, you know, creativity. It's not soft skills. This is really important stuff.
I think there's quite a lot to unpack in there, but a word that I wrote and scribbled big in big capital letters on my notepad there was unlearning and humanity. A, because very similar to you, my career's advice at school was go and be a gardener or a lawyer. And I was like, right, I mean, okay, that's fine. I'm not either of those.
But you said in our old podcast that actually your dream job was to be in forestry. So perhaps the school got it right.
Maybe.
Not on the lawyer front, I mean, for God's sake.
No.
That person needs shooting for saying that. But yeah, on the forestry, perhaps they knew.
But it's, I think that whatever erratic or, you know, convoluted kind of career advice we had in the early 90s, late 80s sort of period of time, right? The creative skills, the creative industries were not one of those options they'd push you down, right?
No.
Unless you were like super talented child genius cello player, or maybe the next Van Gogh, or do you know what I mean? Like,
did any of you go through the computer at school where you put in like 40 things and then it kicked out the job that you should have at the end?
I don't remember.
No, yeah. We had this computer. So I was in that one, I would have been like 91, 92, something like that. I wasn't 91, 92, but in 91 or 92. And the job that kicked out the end for me, and this was their idea of what creativity was you should be a roadie for a band.
Wow.
That is a cool job.
I was quite happy with that. We had loads of other people going, you should be a scientist. But I was, you should be a roadie in a band.
That's not a bad shout. For a career, looking back now, as as we're in the ages beginning with four, right? Being a roadie for a few years would have been pretty cool. But like generally, the creative skills were not thought of as a viable thing. My dad, the same as you guys, right? My dad worked for BT for 42 years. He got a job, worked for 42 years, stopped working. Finished. Yeah. My mum worked for Boots down at Beeston there, like for Boots for 25 years, stopped working. There was no kind of creativity in the job hunting market. Like, it's different now. My daughter's 14 now, right? And she's starting to ask me, like, well, what do you think of doing this? What should I do as I'm older? And I was like, I don't know. Like, honestly, try and do something that you enjoy doing, because I don't know, A, what the jobs are going to be, and I don't have it. There's so much kind of unlearning and change in economy, in the world of work now, that even now in 2021, if I go, well, you should go down this path, by the time it's 2028 or 2030, like, that's pretty old news, right? That's pretty old advice still. But so my advice is just go, look, the being a bit biased against creativity, right? It doesn't matter what subjects you study stuff you like, right? The remembering of the information isn't the important thing. You don't need to understand like algebra or whatever the new math is. Let's not even go down that route, but whatever the new math is like in your job, what you've got to do is try and remember how you solve problems, like think differently about a thing, how you are able to communicate the answer clearly and work with other people in your team, in your group, with your teachers, what questions you can ask about the teachers if you don't understand stuff. That's what work's about, right? Well, whatever job you get in the future, we will train you the skills you need to do the job if you're the suitable person, right? If you've got the right aptitude and attitude, maybe.
I do feel sorry for kids today, in honesty, because there is an abundance of choice. And actually, we all grew up in a time when it was, you know, there's a very structured route to where you want to get to. So there was that whole path of, if you're clever, you're going to go to sixth form. And if you're clever from sixth form, you're going to go to university. If you're not clever, you might go to college. But actually, you might not even go to college because you're not clever enough to even go to college. And therefore, you're going to go straight on to, in my case, a building site. There was a very clear delineation between what people's academic intelligence was. That has, thank God, that line is massively blurred now, because you don't have to be academic to be successful in life. And that's why I feel sorry for, do I feel sorry for kids? Probably not. But what I mean by that is they don't know which is the right route to take now, because they're trying to make the decision off the back of a generation who had it nailed in their minds, even though it was the wrong thing that they were nailed to.
And as a parent, the parents are not equipped enough to advise on all of those options either. No. Because we're like, I don't know but what they are.
It goes nicely back to something that you said, Adam, which was you had that one person in life who said, you know, you've got these skills and you could go and do that.
Yeah, Mrs. Marchant, just to give her a shout out.
Yeah, there you go. Everybody has that one person in life. They've just got to hope that that person has got the right emotional intelligence themselves to say something.
Yeah, and I think it is massively complicated. And I think, you know, there are still... I think the only thing I disagree with you there slightly is I think that, sadly, there are some people that don't have anyone because of circumstances. And that's where... So I was part of a movement called Arts Emergency a few years back, which was to create a series of mentors around the country who would be there for young people that needed support in getting kind of information or guidance on what creative careers might be. So whether that's they want to be a photographer or filmmaker or an actor or whatever it might be, having someone, you know, effectively a kind of alternative, they call it an alternative old boys network, basically. So that if you didn't have any of that reach and you weren't, you know, you were in maybe an unstable kind of parenting situation, or, you know, you were someone who didn't have kind of positive adult role models in your life for one reason or another, or simply not that they weren't positive, but just simply they weren't people that were able to offer you any kind of specific guidance. Because I think things like, I think that's where, and I might be doing people a disservice, but I am a school governor, and, you know, I have some experience of this through other friends and relationships. You know, I think careers guidance is still quite old-fashioned a little bit in the way that it happens. Because, I mean, I don't have the answer to that question you asked, Tim, about what you should say to your 14-year-old daughter by any stretch of the imagination. But if you think about what you care about, what are the things that make you excited, you know, the things that you feel like you can contribute to, and then overlay that with the skills that you have and the knowledge and all the things that you've developed, well, then that is kind of the basis of a happy life. You know, that thing about, you know, if you do a job that you love, you never work a day's, you know, all that jazz, which is not true, because I love my job, but sometimes a massive pain in the ass. and that's the same for all jobs. You know, I was a stand-up for a while. People said, oh, you know, that's an amazing job, and it's really interesting and exciting, all that kind of stuff. And it is, but like when it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you're eating Ginsters at a service station and you know you've got to be in Newcastle the next day, it doesn't feel like it's an amazing... there's still pain...
The stress in that job's got to be... I've got nothing but admiration for stand-ups. I love going to comedy clubs. I love watching them. But the stress in having to stand on a stage and to make people laugh, that's unreal.
And I appreciate that sentiment, Stephen. But the point is, like, all of these people, including myself, like, we like talking in front of people. Do you know what I mean? Like, I loved it when people laughed at things that I said. So yeah, you're right. There are times when it is stressful, when everyone's staring at you like you're an idiot and they're not laughing. Yeah, that is stressful, admittedly. I can remember massive stress points in my life, which now feel ridiculously small. But like, I worked, one of my first jobs was working at Safeways, the supermarket chain. And I was on the deli, right? So that was my place. I was comfortable there. You want me to cut 6 ounces of cheese? Boom, I can do it. Easy, no problem. But then every so often, there'd be this call out where they'd say, all till train staff to the checkouts.
Yeah.
Because people hadn't turned up, someone hadn't turned up for their shift, whatever else. And you learn the till, like, when you first start. But if you're on the deli, you never do it again. So I remember a point where I would swerve it, basically. I found so many ways to swerve it. Like, I'd be in the back messing with a taramasalata or whatever else to kind of avoid it. But there was one time where I couldn't swerve it and I had to go on the desk. And my first customer had all the vouchers, all the 2-for-1, all the discount stuff, loads of questions. I was completely out of my depth. And honestly, that is one of the points in my life where I felt the most stressed. And bear in mind, like, I've done gigs in front of like 1,000 people, and I've managed budgets of 3 million and all that. That seems like that's going to be stressful, but for me, that isn't, because that's kind of my comfort zone. That's that's my wheelhouse, if you like. And again, going back to what we said before as well, anything practical. Oh, Adam, can you just put that shelf up? My mind goes into meltdown. Like, honestly, I'm freaking out at that point. So it's, I think that's it goes back to kind of what we're talking about is, you know, if you feel like you're a square peg in a round hole, you probably are. And actually there probably is a different career out there that's right for you. And it's a privileged thing to say, because not everyone can choose the jobs they do. But I think for young people, before they get to that point, is just try and think about what are those characteristics that make up my round hole and how do I get to that point?
I was just thinking when you mentioned earlier that about IQ and EQ, like having, if there was a way or something to get probably the whole of the every side of the school system, so the teachers, the teaching support, the parents, the kids, right, the students themselves, to understand the value of EQ in comparison to, because it's not a competition, right, but with IQ, like in terms of a big ask, which is schools to stop being, or less so being like judged successful by the grades they churn out at the age of 16, to how successful a life the students have in 5, 10, 15 years time, right? Yeah. Whether is there a way we can govern that? But I think along with that side, I want to unpack and kind of link in to that word mentor you had, right? Because I didn't find out the value of having a mentor really till my 30s, I should think. I started, you know, 30 was when I started to know myself the most confidently, to figure out which way to point all the energy and things that I had, right? But I looked for people who were, you know, and it came from continually learning, like being curious about different things and reading the books and the podcasts and the YouTubes about all of this stuff, and finding people who were like-minded but further along and could offer me trusted advice, right? But I think that role of mentor, if you look into academic theory like Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey, right, the role of the mentor is the key, even though it's not the, you know, the fancy front and center hero of the journey. The mentor is the key, but it's somewhat that's someone to show you the way, right? I think those people exist in abundance. I just think some people, because of their life situation, because of their lived experience, right, are just...
But they don't recognise it.
They don't perceive that's an option, because that role model, and I don't want to say that people in certain situations don't have role models, but that role model is trickier to find, especially vocationally, right, especially to encourage people to explore. But I think... one of the projects, the type of projects you're involved with, Adam, we've had chats recently about creative enterprise zones, and obviously the City of Culture bid for Derby, and you know what that sort of bid has done for other cities and other regions around the UK. But I think creating those hubs, right, creating those condensed little populations, those little pocket cultures of creativity, of like-minded people who are happy and collaborating and living creative industries, whatever that is, like living and working creatively, will act as like a kind of a magnet to those people, hopefully drawing them in. And I think that's part of the plan, right, of creating.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, yeah. And I think, you know, mentoring, again, it's making me think of two things. One, quick shout out to an organisation that I just came into contact with called Aspire, who are a mentoring organisation, mentoring charity run by a lady called Carol Campbell, who basically just said exactly what you said there, Tibby, and there are people in my communities, particularly people from minority ethnic communities, yeah, who are not accessing mentoring, don't know it's there, don't know kind of what they would get out of it, and just, and you know, they don't necessarily have that connection to be able to find the right mentor for them. So she set up a charity which is basically the bridge between those communities and mentors, not specifically around creativity by any stretch of the imagination, but certainly creativity forms part of it. And I think you're right, it's about finding ways to kind of have people that can be that intersection between mentees and mentors going forward. Like from a personal point of view, I've had, I think, four different mentors that have kind of, and I think one of the kind of key things I learned from them was about kind of career journey, and I kind of tested it with all of them to say, you know, you're all successful in your fields, you know, what has been your career journey? How did you manage that? You know, what are the kind of points that you would highlight as kind of being crucial, et cetera, et cetera. And what I found was that all of them, equally successful in their own different ways, but all like completely different paths. So from one extreme where, you know, one person who has had a very delineated plan and has hit all of the milestones along that plan at every point. So in 3 years' time, I'll be doing X. In 6 years' time, I'll be doing Y, and done that. And another person who basically said, my career has been a series of accidental events that I've made the most of and, you know, and just gone from there. So, you know, it's about finding your own way. But I think for me right now, and I think this is one of the things for people that are thinking about mentoring or have got a mentor at the moment to think about, is I think what I need now in terms of mentors are people that have just completely vastly different life experiences to me, so that I can learn from their life experience as well as, you know, because I feel like I'm confident enough in myself now to know the types of careers, the types of jobs, type of industries, etc. And I'm fortunate enough to build up enough kind of contacts to know how those things work. But in terms of that EQ bit, again, I think that's where mentors can really support me going forward to gradually build up and gain more and more empathy around the challenges that people have in different circumstances.
It's strange because I've had one mentor who I still talk to this day. She's been a mentor for probably 15 years or so now. But I would say that I've probably had around 15 to 20 mentors. So I've had one that I've had a one-to-one relationship, but I look at Simon Sinek as a mentor. I've never had a conversation with him, but everything that comes out of his mouth, I listen to. So I think you can have mentors that are classed as A mentors, the ones who you get to have that conversation with, but then you have B mentors as well, who you learn from all the time. So when you read like Phil Knight's book on Shoe Dog, you know, you learn so much from that. The one person I took a lot from was Danny Wallace, who wrote the book Yes Man. Along with, I was a massive fan of Dave Gorman and Danny Wallace. And the Yes Man book, when he said, I'm just going to say yes more. And it made me say yes more to a lot of, and it got me into a lot of different situations where I wouldn't have gone to before. So I may not have one-to-one relationships with them, but I can still use them as a mentor, because I had opened up my emotional intelligence to be able to do that rather than just sit back and not take that on board as a sign I should be doing something.
I think that's a really powerful thing as well there, Stevie, just that concept of saying yes. Flip side, actually, just made me think of something. A friend of mine when I was at university, do you remember the Dice Man? Something Reinhold, I forgot what his name was. Anyway, it was a book basically about a guy who lived his life on the roll of a dice.
Yeah.
And some not very good things end up happening to him. the yes concept is like is a step on from that. But I think it's interesting just that, like, leaving things to chance part of your life sometimes might be quite useful. But yeah, the yes thing, I think that I use this phrase quite a lot, which it probably doesn't define what I actually mean, but it's the simplest way I can describe it, which is just this thing about civic responsibility. And all I mean by that is it's just about caring about the place that you're around and where you've got an opportunity to help support something that isn't directly beneficial to you, try and do it. So that's where I think that yes concept, so whether it's being a school governor or being a trustee of a charity or doing some volunteering or helping out with your local school PTA or whatever it might, any of those things. That's the sort of stuff where, because we're all busy, we're all tired, you know, stuff happens, life's annoying. That's the stuff it's quite easy to say no to, I think, because it's not, you know, it's not something you have to do. But actually, if people started saying yes to that stuff, certainly for me, I cannot count the amount of benefits I've got from doing that kind of activity. It's made my life a much more rounded experience than just work, sleep, you know, have fun, repeat kind of thing.
But that's another Danny Wallace thing, isn't it? Which is random acts of kindness and the Karma Army, which was another thing that he wrote about, which was every Friday afternoon, I'm gonna force myself to do something nice for somebody else. You know, it's not about me, it's going to be about something else. And I think it's really powerful, really powerful. And actually, that came true in the pandemic. When that pandemic first started, and we all stood on the doorstep and we all applauded the NHS, for 6-7 weeks until the NHS turned and said, can you stop clapping? We just want more money now, which is completely understandable. But there was that random, there was that civic duty there. There was that civic looking out for other people. And do you know what? At the time, it was a scary prospect, this pandemic. But actually, I've never felt more close to people at home, more close to people, even though I wasn't seeing my extended family, not seeing them face to face, but I've never felt more close to them. And that was really powerful.
It was kind of weird, wasn't it? Like, I've got friends from school, like that I grew up with, that I've stayed more in touch with my university friends than I have with my friends that I grew up with, because just because of proximity, you know, recency bias to a certain extent. But we set up this kind of like WhatsApp group a while ago, and actually the pandemic was the point where it really kind of exploded and we started talking to each other more. And then we started doing like online gaming together, and we did some, you know, we did some other kind of like Zoom meetups, and we've been doing a, you know, stupid stuff like a fantasy football league or whatever, all of that kind of stuff. But suddenly I'm having daily almost conversations with people that I spent huge bits of my life with as a kid. And then there was a massive chunk of my life where I just never spoke to them. Not because I fell out with them or didn't like them, just because life took over. Yeah. And actually the pandemic sort of made people talk to each other more, I think, which is a really powerful thing as well.
Yeah, I hope, we said this many a times, but some of the good things that did come out, because not there's a lot of bad came out of the pandemic, but it's a lot of good things that did come. And actually that sense of community and that sense of belonging, I just hope that as a world and as people that we try to keep that and grab onto it. Because do you know what, you don't get many opportunities to reset, and we got chance to reset.
I echo that, right? And I think I've been thinking about that sort of change that's happened, right? That, because it, in my lifetime, right, in the 40 odd years I've been knocking around, right, the last 2 years, right, the COVID times, have been the first enforced change I've had to. I'm sure there's been others, but the one that's directly affected me, you know, there might have been some when I was a nipper and not really realised about economic, but this has been the first time everybody has had change put upon them, right? It's not been a choice. But I think that has amplified some of the things that were not devalued, but and not forgotten, but just kind of were pushed to the side by the busyness and the fruitfulness of life. You know, you like before COVID, we could, in theory, go anywhere we want, do whatever we want through kind of choice, right? We could wang around, we could travel, we could see whoever we like it was a thing. But connection, right, is the thing that's been amplified the most, and our perceived value of that. And when I say connection, I don't mean, of course, connection to people, right, but also connection to place, so your local community, your area. Right. I've lived in this house that I'm recording from now for 11 years. Right. It was last year that I only kind of referred to it as where I lived before. I slept here and kept my stuff here, but I didn't do anything here. We went out every weekend. Days were filled from 6 o'clock going to the gym and then filling my evenings with networking or drinks or social stuff. I didn't live it. I came here to shower, sleep, get dressed again and leave. It's what I did.
It was your hotel.
That wasn't on purpose. That's the thing wrong with it. But that life wasn't connected to this place, if you know what I mean. It was something I did in other places. And I think that connection's really interesting. And then the connection to new ideas. I know so many people, and I know, like, you attract people who think the same way, that are connected to new ideas or have become disconnected with what they've been doing for 20, 30 years and just kind of hold on. I've had a little bit of time to think and reconsider, you know, and have reconnected with people. I'm not sure what I've been doing now has been the right thing to make me happy for 40 years. It's paid the bills, it's bought me a house, and, you know, all good things, right? Not bad things. But I think that it seemed to have catalyzed a connection to new ideas, that people can actually do something for them that's impactful, that's, you know, that still attracts the triple bottom line of pennies, people and planet. Do you know what I mean? Like, it has impact in that, but something different. Like, I think there's connection to a lot of ideas, a lot of people, a lot of situations that have made us unlearn or start to question what we consider work to be, what we consider relationships to be, family to be, location to be, place to be. And I just think it's a good thing to have come out of it. And those little nuggets of stuff that have started to be amplified, I would like to keep.
Yeah, well, there's a really, another kind of shout out, a really good example of a project in Derby that I think sort of brings all that together, which is the thing called the Down to Earth Project, which is a guy called Jamie Starkey, who is works at Rolls-Royce, and this started pre-pandemic, to be fair, but at some point he recognised he'd lost his connection with nature, and it was something that he loved, and even his own garden, it was a place, like you were saying there, Tim, that he kind of just, you know, went into every now and again, but he didn't really take much notice of it. It was just a place that was attached to his house, really. So he decided to kind of start where he's in his own garden and start converting things. Then he got an allotment, and then he started getting other people involved in the allotment. Then he started doing rambles in the Peak District with people. And this is, bearing in mind, this is a kind of, you know, mid to late 20s, young man, tattoos, very cool looking, you know, a lot more interesting, and younger, more virile and excitable than we are at our cynical older ages, but, you know, not someone that you would necessarily associate with an allotment, stuff for starters. Yeah. Created this project called Down to Earth Derby, and over time he's just got more and more people accumulating around him, people that have suddenly also had the same feelings about wanting to connect with nature. And this, and part of the reason for the title of the thing, the Down to Earth concept, is him feeling disenfranchised by the challenges around climate change and feeling like, you know, AI work in an industry that is contributing to that. So that's one negative for me. That's a challenge. B, I just don't know what I as an individual can do about this. And then what that created was just inertia, ultimately. He just did nothing. He kind of just got into this bubble of nothingness, really. So the Down to Earth Project is to say, look, there are simple, practical ways that you can get real benefits from engaging with nature, and that collectively we can create a more circular economy where we're growing food, we're cooking food, we're working with young people that have maybe kind of don't really know what they're interested in, but can come along and they can learn about growing food and they can learn about cooking alongside us. And it's become, you know, there's education elements to it, and he does workshops now with local community groups, and it's just grown and grown and grown. And for him, you know, the potential horizon for it is endless, to the point where, you know, he's been talking to people at the Eden Project about where the Eden Project came from, from and what that might look like. And he's ambitious enough to say, you know, I want to create Derby's own version of the Eden Project. Well, that's amazing. Like, it's not an easy thing, and there's no simple way of getting to that point, but this is someone who doesn't have to do that, that's found something he's really passionate about and is bringing communities together in a completely different way. So I think there are, you know, like we've said, let's not pretend this has been a horrendous time for everyone. And, you know, I've lost some people close to me, and other people have as well. So there's horrendous things that have occurred. But I think that ability for us to just stop and take a step back and go, what's important? And it's all of those things we've talked about. But for me, it's also, you know, like porters in hospitals, some of the lowest paid people in our society. How important are they? You know, how important are all of those people that are cleaning the hospitals during this time, the people that create the medical supplies, the people that are the delivery drivers, all of those people that you take no notice of generally in life, suddenly people are waking up and going, actually, without them, my life does not function and we're in a much worse place. So hopefully, and it's obviously not within our gift to do this, but hopefully at some point there's a further recognition of the importance of everyone's role in society and what they play.
The three points that you made at the beginning around emotional intelligence and IQ and soft skills versus hard skills, to talking about staring at the sun book, about death and actually enjoying life and death, we've actually just covered all three of those without even trying. That being scripted, that's
done. Easy, done.
Some things are just meant to happen, aren't they?
They are. I think, you know, like there's, like the reason for this podcast is to speak to people who are doing remarkable things. And we don't mean like flying to the moon like Elon Musk. Although if Elon, you are listening and you want to come on, that's cool. But it's about, you know, the like normal people like us three trying to do like remarkable stuff in our little world. Like I remember us having a coffee and we were talking about, was it Jamie, the allotment?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
And I follow him on Instagram now. Super, like what he's built in that little,
cool, isn't it? Yeah.
That little square of countryside, like of ground, is amazing. Like, and he look like we're definitely going to try and get him on the podcast, because I think, like, even if the change that we've been through or the changes that will come, like changes in the air, I think, without going down that rabbit hole, but like if that encourages the odd people like Jamie to go, do you know what, I'm just going to do this thing and hopefully other people will come along, but maybe I'll just do it for me, you know, maybe other people join me, is what needs to be kind of encouraged and championed with, you know, through people like doing the work that you're doing, Adam, like the City of Culture and the Creative Enterprise Zone stuff, and the work through Quad, which is a, you know, a beacon for creativity in the city centre of Derby, if not the whole thing. We'll put links to everything in the chat, obviously, so people can reference what we're on about in there. But also something that we spoke about in version one of the pod, Steve, is like we people who have a voice or give other people voices, right? The creative people, right? Yeah. Have a responsibility to put those stories out into the world, right? The noise we make, right, the things that come out of our mind or our fingers or our mouths, right, should promote those stories, right? Because the last year or so, they matter, and they matter even more as being foundational for the economy and the future and the cities and the communities we need to create, right? I think we're just at that. If anything, if the people listen to this podcast take away is that, do you know what I mean? Like, look, you don't have to do anything crazy, like be able to like first man-powered flight to the moon, right? You just make a difference in your little corner of the world. Be the best human you can be. Like, do you know what I mean? And I think that
it's true. We are, for me, I believe we're on the cusp of being able to make a difference rather than people telling us what difference to make. So whereas before we used to follow tabloid media and listen to every word that was said, we're now moving away from that and taking on board our own knowledge, our own understanding, and trying to impart that, you know, in local communities. And I hope that we go back to that. I really do. It's so, when you stand back and you look at it and you see things, how polar opposites we've been in this country for so many years now, from Brexit votes to anti-vaxxers to all these different things. It's, you know, they're the bits that are dragging everybody down. They're the conversations that drag everybody down. If we could just focus on community first and grow outwards again, we could let it bloom and just, we could be a happy generation again. That's what we want to get to, isn't it?
Civic responsibility, like
exactly right.
Yeah, it's just exactly. It's just that, like, I do absolutely believe in civic responsibility, but I think it's like one of the most boring phrases you can find. Like, it needs to be rebranded, basically, because whenever I say it out loud, I'm like, that sounds like something someone's telling me to do. You know what I mean? It sounds terrible, doesn't it? Who wants? Do you fancy doing a bit of civic responsibility? No, sounds awful.
You could get it sponsored by Honda, though.
But another example of that is, and this is where I think, you know, like what you were talking about, Stephen, creativity being part of everyone's lives. It doesn't have to necessarily come through arts, it can be through lots of different ways. There's another organization in Derby called Aspire Wrestling. So it's another Aspire, and they're basically a wrestling for well-being organisation. So they use wrestling and encourage people to get involved in it to improve people's well-being and mental health, etc. So it's kind of an extent, you know, think like way back in time, your only way out of working class communities was like boxing clubs or football or the mines, you know, that they were your options. So it's kind of taking that principle that actually there are kids that aren't necessarily going to be interested in the stuff that we do at Quad, you know, they're not going to necessarily be interested in digital media or contemporary art or whatever else, because that's, you know, and I know this coming from a community, I didn't know anything about those things when I was a kid, and I know a lot about it now, and I know how much benefit it has to it, but I also recognize there are communities where, you know, even words like arts and culture are kind of turnoffs, and they create barriers. So, you know, Aspire Wrestling is there, and it's an amazing thing within, you know, you've got people of all ages going along and practicing and wrestling is one of those things that I, you know, I've got a vague memory of it from the kind of, like you said, late 80s, early 90s, you know,
Big Daddy era.
ITV on a Saturday afternoon, there was the British wrestling, wasn't there, which was very much lo-fi version of then what became American wrestling.
And then they brought in the WWF with Rowdy Roddy Piper, the Bushwhackers, Legion. I went to SummerSlam 92, so just leave it there.
Hey, golden era. So like that's my kind of vague knowledge of it, but there's people that I work with, really interesting people who are wrestling is one of their main hobbies, and not doing it, but watching it and watching the guitar and watching it as an art form, almost as an entertainment. And those kind of principles are contained within Aspire Wrestling as well. And I think that's the point, is that, you know, you don't have to just do what everyone else is doing. If, you know, and I'm really not saying these are a bad, well, they are a bad thing that we need to have them conceptually, but the people that do it are brilliant. But things like food banks, for example, you know, the outcome does not have to be a food bank for it to have an impact on a community in a positive way. And if someone said to you, you know, no one's going to say, do you know what we really need? We need a wrestling organisation that's focused on wellbeing. Like, no one's going to say that. No one's going to kind of like sort of, you know, no kind of, there's not going to be any funding specifically for that. No one in the local authority is going to say this is what is needed. It needs someone from the community to come up and go, I think wrestling is something that can really engage lots of people. And they've done it and they've proved that it works. And this is exactly the sort of thing where, again, it's kind of, you know, you could imagine wrestling for well-being becoming a thing all across the UK now.
Yeah.
I mean, look at there's been some amazing projects like that in skateboarding world, right? Like derelict, disused and misused old buildings, right, being used, you know, for the, but you know, maybe drug dealers, homeless people, like just misused, right, beautiful spaces being converted into skate parks and skate ramps. In our neighbouring city, where you are, Steve, in Nottingham, there's an amazing story of a skate park there. But yeah, look fine. Now, like a 13-year-old girl has just won a gold. Well,
Sky Brown, she got bronze.
Got bronze medal, yeah. Right?
For but the gold medal winner was 12, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was.
Like,
yeah.
If I was yeah. Sky Brown, I'd be like, brilliant, I'm 13, I got bronze. The person who won is 12. But you're joking.
So I've got two daughters, one's age 10 and the other one's age 6. My 6-year-old wanted a skateboard for her birthday in February. May. So we got her a skateboard.
Nice.
She watched Sky Brown. The next day was the first day she took it out, and she is a natural. I'm over the moon.
There you go.
She was
11-year-old gold medalist.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm aiming for 10. Let's just
break some records.
But it, you know, to see that inspiration of a 13-year-old bronze medalist at the Olympics inspiring my 6-year-old daughter in Nottingham, that's you can't ask for more. I was so bought into the Olympics. Everything was on telly. I was like, you want to give fencing a go? You can give it a go.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking about doing modern pentathlon.
Pentathlon, that's the one. That is the one. If you could do modern pentathlon. I think those people that won the gold medal, like, honestly, just, all other sports people need to just stop and go modern pentathlon. Horse riding, fencing, shooting, running, swimming.
Yeah.
Or, like, who else can do that? That's unbelievable.
But it made me also go. So I got quite data driven on this around the Olympics. So if you wanted to become an athlete, X amount of people going to be wanting to become an athlete every year. So your chance at doing that is like 1 in 600,000 if you've got the talent. Whereas if you wanted to do modern pentathlon, not many people know about it until now. But if you started to do that now, you'll probably have like a 1 in 500 chance of being able to do it.
Okay.
So you've got more of a chance to go to the Olympics by doing modern pentathlon than you have on, if you know, like to get into the 100-meter running team.
Well, I'll be honest, right? I do still harbour an Olympic dream, and it is obviously waning. Do. Yeah, exactly. It's waning, but I still think there's
shooting in the shooting arena, maybe.
Can well, do that.
The one remaining Olympic sport I think I could, if I started now and I really committed to it, which is clearly not going to happen, but if I did, the one remaining sport that I could potentially get in the Olympics with is curling in the Winter Olympics.
Yeah.
But
everybody does that now.
I've done curling twice. The problem is, like, there's no they're all in Scotland, basically. There's one curling rink in England, which is in Tunbridge Wells. The rest of them are all in Scotland. So there's a bit of a Scottish bias towards that already. And then the other opportunity, which is not Olympics at the moment, but could potentially be, will be Crown Green Bowls. You know, physically, I think I could still just about do Crown Green Bowls.
You know, but with Derby being a city of culture, perhaps it needs a curling rink put in place.
Ooh, yeah, that's an idea.
Inner city bowling, I think, is the idea we should cap this conversation on, because it's a good one. I don't think we're going to peak after inner city Crown Green Bowling for Adam Buss's Olympic dreams. In 2025? Are you going for?
No,
2029.
Yeah. Yeah, well, in the next Olympics, breakdancing's in the next Olympics.
It is, yeah, freestyle breakdancing.
So, you know, I did used to have the worm. That was still there. I don't know if I can pull that one out.
Amazing. Well, Adam, thanks very much for that conversation. There's so many notes and avenues that we could have gone down, so maybe you'll have to come back in a bit and update us on City of Culture, and we'll go down another rabbit hole. But for the time being, where's a good place for people to find you or check you out, or where would you like to direct the good people who listen to this podcast?
All of the social media channels: Instagram Adam Lloyd Buss, Twitter Adam Lloyd Buss. You can find me there. LinkedIn for the, you know, duller conversations potentially. But you know, I'm all over those. So yeah, just get in touch, say hello.
That would be amazing. Right, we'll put all those links to the chat and everything that Adam referred to, the book, Staring at the Sun, both the Aspires, the wrestling and the mentoring, and the and Jamie, the magical allotment guy, who is now my favourite top three Instagram accounts to watch and stalk passively. But otherwise, what a lovely episode. Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure, chaps. Thank you.
Well, what a remarkable episode that was.
A remarkable episode. Like we planned it.
Is it? We just shoehorned that title in everywhere. And it will continue every time you listen to the end of a podcast. And we know when it comes to outros, not a lot of people do continue to listen. We might have flicked on to the next great guest that we've had on. But if you're still here, that was remarkable. And the next guest will be remarkable too.
There will be a link tree in our social medias where you can get hold of a Google form, where you can send us questions, you can get in touch, you can give us recommendations, and you can let us know if you know anybody remarkable that you think we should talk to on this show. Please do that.
And thank you very much to our sponsor, Bant.io.
Bant.io. Legends, thanks very much. Peace out. I know nobody's listening anyway. Take care.
See y'all.